Chapter 11, Satan's Bargain.
Satan cast a false revelation on the messenger of God's tongue.
The motley crew that slinked out of Mecca under the cover of darkness included Muhammad's daughter, Ruqayya. Other notables were named Slave to the House, Slave to Ar-Rahman, Slave to the sun god Manaf, and Slave to Allah, and to Allah's daughter, Al-Uzza. It was a pagan potpourri.
Tabari. The messenger remained in Mecca, preaching in secret and openly, protected by his uncle Abu Talib.
It was another Islamic first. A secretive prophet was being protected by a 70-year-old pagan.
When the Quraysh saw that they had no means of attacking him physically, they accused him of sorcery, soothsaying, and madness, and of being a poet. They began to keep those away from him whom they feared might listen and follow him.
I have distilled a best-of-the-Meccans list of accusations against Muhammad and his claims from the hundreds that permeate the Quran. For your reading pleasure.
He is a liar and a magician. He is possessed by devils. He is an insane, plagiarizing poet.
The Meccans called him.
A lunatic, a far-fetched forger, a fool, a specious pretender, and deceitful. The unbelievers said he is a deceiving sorcerer, turning many gods into one deity.
They saw an ulterior
motive behind the Quran. It is a fabrication. They laughed at the Quran. Allah hasn't sent down anything. You are only speaking lies. This is nothing but pure sorcery. The unbelievers say the Quran is nothing but earlier people's lore. These are fables of antiquity, which he has reinvented. What sort of prophet is this? Why was no angel sent to him? These are only confused dreams. He has invented them. Let him bring a miracle to us, as the earlier prophets did. They said of the prophet, he has forged the Quran. We find him full of folly and a liar to boot.
Rather than preach salvation to his tribe, Muhammad taunted his accusers.
Some of them talk ill of the prophet. For those who offend Allah's apostle, there is a painful punishment. Anyone who opposes Allah and his prophet will abide in hell forever.
In a duet with Allah, Muhammad bellowed, My critics are...
Despicable men, contemptible swearers, backbiters. They are feeble scandalmongers.
Carried away in the moment, the God of the Quran said that his creation were...
Mischief-mongers, faggots, apes, nail-biters, donkeys, pigs, and tongue-twisters.
It was a war of words. The sticks and stones would come later. Muslim apologists insist that the Prophet's warmongering in Medina was a result of the Meccan verbal abuse. But according to the Hadith, it was Muhammad who tongue-lashed first. The Meccan response was measured and reasonable. They sought peace through diplomacy and were ultimately terrorized, plundered, and conquered as a result. Their plight should scream out to us today. The Islam versus pagan contest seldom rose above a war of words in Mecca.
Ishaq and Tabari. The nastiest thing I saw the Quraysh do to the messenger occurred when their nobles assembled in the Hijr,
the standing place in the mosque of the Kaaba.
They discussed Muhammad, saying, We have never seen the kind of trouble we have endured from this fellow. He has derided our traditional values, declared our way of life foolish, abused and insulted our forefathers, reviled our religion, caused divisions among us, divided the community, and cursed our gods.
Allah was their most revered idol. Saying that Muhammad insulted him is an indictment on Islam. And he couldn't have reviled their religion to any significant degree because he incorporated every aspect of Qusay's scam into Islam. Therefore, the real problem lay elsewhere. This prophet made himself a societal nuisance. He destroyed traditional values, caused divisions among the people, and assailed both the living and the dead.
We have endured a great deal from him. While they were saying this, the apostle walked up and kissed the black stone. Then he performed the circumambulation of the Kaaba. As he did this, some said injurious things about him. I could see from the messenger's face that he had heard them. When he passed a second time, they made similar remarks. When he passed them a third time, the prophet stopped and said, "Hear me, O Quraysh, by him who holds Muhammad's life in his hand, I will bring you slaughter."
The founder of Islam was performing pagan rites, kissing a rock idol, and venerating a rock shrine. He had attacked the traditional values of his people, demeaned their ancestors, and caused division. He had built his religion of submission upon doctrines he had stolen from Qusay, Hanif poetry, and Jewish scripture. And for what? So he could lay claim to Allah's fountain of Qusar, the Kaaba Inc.? And if you think my summation is too harsh, consider what just happened. After enduring years of hate speech from Muhammad, the Meccans criticized him. They accurately labeled the prophet's religion plagiarized madness and sorcery. In response, the founder of Islam turned to his accusers and said,
"I will bring you slaughter."
Not salvation, not good news, not a wonderful message from a loving God. No, I will bring you slaughter. It was Muhammad's message to the world, and he performed as promised. The Meccans were stunned by this response to their verbal jousting, as we should be today. They were in the presence of a covetous charlatan, and they knew it. Unfortunately, they didn't respond intelligently. They were wary of condemning a religion. They were deluded into thinking that a tyrant could be appeased. As a result, the Meccans would lose everything by accommodating the evil that had grown up in their midst.
Tabari. They were gripped by what he had said. The word he used struck people so that no one could move. It was as though everyone had a bird perched on his head. Even those who had been urging the severest measures against him now spoke in a conciliatory way, using the politest expressions they could muster. They said, "Depart, Abu al-Qasim,"
Muhammad's real name,
"for by Allah, you were never violent."
At least he wasn't before he became demon-possessed and poisoned by Islam. Peace is not the absence of war. It is not obtained through accommodation. These men wanted to live in peace, so they capitulated. They strove to understand their menace, to talk nicely to their tormentor, to satiate his demands. They were politically correct and got pummeled for it. Their olive branches of kindness were turned into spears of reprisal. Within a decade or so of this peace initiative, the entire Middle East, from Egypt to India, was stung by the Islamic war machine. Appeasing tyrants is the surest path to war. Neville Chamberlain appeased Adolf Hitler in Munich, using his nicest words. He, like the Meccans, caved in to the madman's demands. The Brits gave the Nazis Czechoslovakia. The deadliest war in human history was the result. Today, the world is trumpeting another Land for Peace initiative in hopes of satiating a terrorist regime. But as before, if a nation is sacrificed to a hostile doctrine, if Israel is given up to Islam, the world will erupt in global war. But this time, the weapons are so much better, 1 billion people may die. Negotiating with tyrants simply fuels their fanaticism. No matter how much one gives, it is never enough. Evil must never be allowed to fester and grow, even if it's called a religion.
Tabari. The prophet left, and the next day they gathered at the Hirja, and I,
Abdallah,
was again present. You were talking about the unpleasantness which you endured at the things Muhammad has done, but when he said something disagreeable, you shrank from him.
As a result, the doves were consumed by the hawk.
Ishaq and Bukhari. Then I saw Uqbah coming to the prophet while he was praying. He seized his robe. Abu Bakr came and pulled Uqbah away. He said, "Would you kill a man just because he says Allah is my Lord?" Then they left him. This is the worst that I ever saw the Quraysh do to him.
Baker's overreaction to the tug on his pal's lapel was contrived to make sure Muslims wouldn't miss the intent of the 40th surah. Challenge Islam and you die. In it, Muhammad corrupted the story of Moses to frighten the Meccans. The applicable verse is 40:38.
A believer from the house of Pharaoh, who had kept his faith to himself, said, "Will you kill a man because he says, 'My Lord is Allah,' when he has brought you clear signs from his Lord?"
So as not to take this verse or surah out of context, we'll review it at the end of the chapter.
Tabari and Ishaq. Hamza bin Abdul Muttalib came with his bow slung over his shoulder. He was a great huntsman and used to go out for game with his bow and arrows. When he came back from the hunt, he would not go back to his family until he had circumambulated the Kaaba. He was the strongest man of the Quraysh. A woman rose up and said, "If only you had seen what your nephew Muhammad had to endure just now before you came." Abu Jahl spoke to him offensively. Hamza was carried away by fury, as it was Allah's will to honor him in this way.
In Islam, it's an honor to be furious.
He went off quickly, not stopping to speak to anyone. Instead of circumambulating the Kaaba, he was ready to attack Abu Jahl when he saw him. When he entered the mosque...
This is a reminder that the Kaaba was a pagan mosque, or place of prostration, before it was the center of Islamic worship. Further, the prostration prayer, Islam's signature move, preceded the Quran.
He saw him sitting among the people. Hamza raised his bow and gave Abu a blow which split his head open in an ugly way. He said, "Do you insult him when I am a member of his religion? Hit me back if you can."
Before Islam, Hamza hunted animals for food. After Islam, he hunted humans for his god. While he was but a lone terrorist with a bow, he established the pattern that would soon rock the world. The change did not escape notice.
Tabari and Ishaq. Hamza's Islam was complete. He followed the Prophet's every command. The Quraysh recognized that, by Hamza's acceptance of Islam, Muhammad had been made strong. Hamza would protect him.
Violence made a man's Islam complete, and a man made a prophet strong.
Ishaq and Tabari. The first to recite the Quran aloud in Mecca after the apostle was Abdallah bin Mas'ud. On the day the companions of the Prophet were assembled together,
all five of them,
and remarked, "The Quraysh have never heard this Quran recited aloud to them. Who will make them listen to it?"
This is an astonishing admission. Muhammad is 50 years old and a decade into his mission. Mecca is a tiny place, clustered around a minuscule shrine. 80 surahs have been revealed, 75% of the Quran, yet...
"The Quraysh have never heard this Quran recited aloud to them."
Then what, pray tell, was the source of the war of words between Muhammad and his critics? If Muhammad wasn't preaching God's word, what on earth was he saying that was so obnoxious?
Abdallah bin Mas'ud said, "I will." They said, "We fear what they will do to you. What we want is a man who has a clan who will protect him against them if they seek to harm him." He...
foolishly
replied, "Let me do it. Allah will protect me."
But alas, Allah was never into the miracle business. Tabari didn't reference the surah Mas'ud elected to recite. Ishaq did. I was stunned to learn that it was the 55th.
Ar-Rahman.
The hadith claims Allah's protection, yet Mas'ud was singing Ar-Rahman's praises. It's little wonder the Meccans were up in arms. Muhammad was venerating Allah's house, their Kaaba, but he was claiming that it belonged to a rival moon god.
Ishaq. The next day, Ibn Mas'ud went to the Kaaba in the late morning when the Quraysh were gathering there in groups. He turned toward them as he recited, in Quran 55, verse 1, "Ar-Rahman bestowed the Quran. He created man. He taught man eloquent speech and intelligence. The sun and moon are made punctual, following courses. They revolve to a computation."
According to the Islamic God, the sun moves, not the earth.
"Ar-Rahman created the herbs, or stars, and the trees, all of which prostrate themselves."
Mas'ud proudly proclaimed,
"He created man of fermented clay, dried tingling hard like earthenware, and created jinn from the white-hot flame of fire. How many favors of your Lord will you both deny?"
Arachman, like Allah, made man as one would distill alcohol.
Quran 55:19. He has set the two seas,
not seven,
in motion that flow side by side with a barrier between them that they cannot cross.
Wrong again.
How many favors of your Lord will you both deny?
How many lies must the dark spirit of Islam utter before Muslims deny him? The first Meccan Quran recital turned nasty with these words.
Quran 55:31. Soon we will dispose of you both, men and jinn, by applying our two armies. How many favors of your Lord will you both deny?
A second translation reads,
we shall soon be free to turn on you, O weary caravans.
Muhammad would soon prosper by raiding Meccan caravans.
Verse 35. There will be let loose on you both white-hot flames of fire and smoke that chokes, so that you will not be able to defend yourselves. How many favors of your Lord will you both deny?
Arachman makes jinn out of the same material he will use to torture men. That means the dark spirit of Islam intends to send his demons after us. Unless we forget, this spirit considers torture a favor. Masood continued to recite the
Arachman
Surah to the Meccans.
Quran 55, verse 41. The sinners will be seized by their forelock and feet. Which of the favors of your Lord will you then deny? This is the hell the sinners called a lie. They will go round and round between its fierce fires and boiling water. Which of the favors of your Lord will you then deny?
Apart from Satan, can you imagine any spirit suggesting that burning and scalding were favors? Having sickened the Quraysh with demonic torments, Masood teased them with decadence.
Quran 55:46. For him who lives in terror of his Lord are two gardens containing delights, shade, two fountains flowing, fruits in pairs, reclining on carpets lined with silk brocade, fruits hanging low. In them, virginal females with averted glances, desiring none but you, undeflowered by men or jinn. Is the reward of goodness aught but goodness?
Arachman has just labeled decadence good, and living in terror is the path to paradise.
Verse 62. And beside this, there are two other gardens, rich green in color from plentiful watering. In them will be two springs gushing forth, and fruits, and beautiful companion, virgins cloistered in pavilions, undefiled by men and jinn, reclining on green cushions and rich mattresses. Which of the favors of your Lord will you both deny?
I would have loved to have seen the reaction on the Meccans' faces as they listened to Muhammad's religious disciple recite this demonic message.
Ishaq and Tabari. The Meccans took notice of Masood. What on earth is this son of a slave's mother saying? Then they said, he is reciting some of what Muhammad has prayed.
Not recited, prayed. These fantasies represented Muhammad's cravings.
They rose up and began to hit him in the face.
So much for Allah's protection.
He continued to recite as much as Allah willed that he should, and then he went back to his companions with the marks of their blows on his face. They said, this is what we feared would happen to you. But he replied, the enemies of God were never more despicable in my sight than they are now. If you wish, I will do the same thing to them tomorrow. They replied, no, you have done enough.
It's the cause and effect of Islam. The religion causes Muslims to hate everyone who isn't a Muslim. It's a condition that persists to this day. The Sirah follows this incriminating encounter with another. Muhammad was afraid to recite the Quran in public, so the Meccans eavesdropped outside his mud hut one night.
Ishaq, when they heard the Quran, they said, in mocking, our hearts are veiled. We do not understand what he is saying. There is a load in our ears. Then Allah revealed, and when you recite the Quran, we put between you and those who do not believe a hidden veil. They turn in aversion. In secret councils, the mockers say, they are following a man bewitched.
The next Ishaq segment is omitted by Tabari. I can only assume that the historian couldn't find a credible supporting tradition, or he had collected enough contrary hadiths to question its truth.
Ishaq, the Quraysh showed their enmity to those who followed the apostle. Every clan which contained Muslims attacked them, imprisoning them, beating them, allowing them no food or drink, and exposing them to the burning heat of Mecca, so as to seduce them from their religion. Some gave way under pressure of persecution, and others resisted.
Considering that Muhammad had threatened to slaughter the Quraysh, they may have been justified. Further, the doctrine Muhammad was espousing was corrosive. It turned peaceful men into killers. Ishaq was able to provide only one example of abuse.
A rock was put on a slave's chest. When Abu Bakr complained, they said, "You are the one who corrupted him, so save him from his plight." "I will do so," said Bakr. "I have a black slave, tougher and stronger than Bilal, who is a heathen. I will exchange him." The transaction was carried out.
Even when these boys did something right, it was wrong. Trading slaves wasn't religious, and calling a black man a heathen was racist.
Tabari, Umar bin al-Khattab,
the caliph who ruled during Islam's bloodiest conquests,
was a staunch and mighty warrior. He accepted Islam and had Hamza before him. The messenger's companions began to feel stronger. Ishaq, Umar became a Muslim. He became a strong, stubborn man whose proteges none dared attack. The Prophet's companions were so fortified by him and Hamza that they got the upper hand on the Quraysh. We could not pray at the Kaaba until Umar became a Muslim, and then he fought the Quraysh until we could pray there.
The warrior's acceptance of Islam enabled the Prophet to change his qibla from faith to power, from religion to politics, from a war of words to a clash of arms. While the results of Umar aligning his sword with Muhammad's mission are undeniable, one question lingers. Why did he join the fledgling force? Did Muhammad lure Umar into Islam with promises of drunken orgies?
"Delights in gardens of pleasure, on couches facing one another, a cup from a gushing spring of wine, white, delicious to the drinkers. None shall be made mad or exhausted thereby. On thrones raised high with maidens incomparable, lo, we have formed their companions as a special creation, and made them to grow a new growth. We made them virgins, pure and undefiled, lovers matched in age for those on the right hand."
Or did Muhammad terrorize Umar into submission with his depictions of hell?
"Soon I will fling them into the burning hell fire. It permits nothing to endure, and nothing does it spare. It darkens and changes the color of man, burning the skin. It shrivels and scorches men. Let him beware. If he does not desist, we will seize him, smite his forehead, and drag him by the forelock. For the rejectors is entertainment with boiling water and roasting in hell fire. Truly, hell is a place of ambush, a resort for the rebellious. Therein taste they neither coolness nor any drink save a boiling water and a fluid of dark, murky, intensely cold, paralyzing, a fitting reward. They will eat thorns and fill their bellies with the heads of flaming devils. Then, on top of that, they will be given a mixture made of boiling water to drink, especially prepared. We have prepared the doom of hell and the penalty of torment in the most intense blazing fire. When they are flung in, they will hear the terrible drawing in of their breath and loud moaning, even as the flame blazes forth, roaring as with rage as it boils up, bursting with fury, plucking apart his body right to the skull. Eager to roast, dragged by the head, hell shall claim all who flee."
Or do you suppose he tempted him with booty, a share in Khadijah's profitable profit plan?
"As for the favor your Lord has bestowed upon you, Muhammad, announce it. Soon your Lord will give you so much that you shall be pleased. He found you poor and enriched you. Of the bounty of your Lord let your discourse be. Muhammad claims that Allah has sent him as his messenger with this religion so that the treasures of Crusos and Caesar will be given to him by conquest. I want them to utter one saying. If they say it, the Arabs will submit to them, and the non-Arabs will pay the jizya tax in submission. The use of booty from the spoils of war are lawful and good. Know that one-fifth of what you acquire as booty is for Allah and His Apostle. If they ask you of the benefits of accruing the spoils of war, tell them, the benefits belong to Allah and His Messenger.
And perhaps will be shared with Umar. I don't know if Umar is in hell with Allah, tormenting infidels, or lounging in the brothels of bliss, but I do know Islam made the Islamic warrior king very, very rich. Ishaq went to great lengths to explain Umar's conversion.
Umar said, I am making my way to Muhammad, the apostate who split up the Quraysh and made a mockery of our traditions to kill him. Your sister, Fatima, has become a Muslim, so you had better go and deal with her first. Umar heard her reciting Kabab.
There is no surah by that name, and it isn't referenced in the text.
As he came near the house, he said, What is this balderdash? You have heard nothing, she lied. By Allah, I have, Umar said, striking his sister in the face and wounding her. When he saw the blood, he felt sorry and asked to hear what Fatima was reciting. You are unclean in your polytheism, and only the clean may listen to it.
He washed his hands of the violence he had inflicted, and she graced him with a little recital. The brute proclaimed,
How fine and noble is this speech! Lead me to Muhammad, that I may accept Islam.
Leaving the surah and returning to the sunnah, we discover.
Tabari. The revelation from Allah was coming to the Prophet continuously, commanding and threatening those who showed open hostility to him, and vindicating him against those who opposed him.
And so it would be. Reading the 90 Meccan surahs is like listening to a decade-long argument. They said, You're a lying, plagiarizing charlatan, a fraud and a sorcerer. There is surely a motive behind all this madness. He said, I am not a lying madman or a demon-possessed sorcerer, and because you have mocked me, I will bring you slaughter. With that recap, we can dispense with the remaining score of Meccan surahs and move on with the story. At this point, Ibn Ishaq reveals a stunning temptation, one which I have entitled the Quraysh Bargain.
Utbah, who was a chief, said while sitting in a Quraysh assembly, Why don't I go to Muhammad and make some proposals to him? If he accepts, we will give him whatever he wants, and he will leave us in peace. They thought it was a good idea, because if they tried to negotiate with him, they would no longer be blamed for his actions. So Utbah went to the Prophet, who was sitting in the mosque by himself, and said, O my nephew, you are one of us, yet you have come to our people with a matter that is dividing the community. You are ridiculing our customs. You have insulted our gods and our religion. You have even declared that our forefathers were infidels. So listen to me, and I will make some suggestion, and perhaps you will be able to accept one of them. The apostle agreed. Utbah said, If what you want is money, we will gather for you some of our property, so that you may be the richest man in town. If you want honor, we will make you chief, so that no one can decide anything apart from you. If you want sovereignty, we will make you king. And if this demonic spirit which has possession of you is such that you cannot get rid of him, we will find a physician for you, and exhaust our means trying to cure you. For often a demonic spirit gets possession of a man, but how can he be rid of it? The apostle listened patiently.
Wow, the surah is incriminating. While Muhammad hesitated, the Meccans went on the offensive, hitting every one of his hot buttons. They charged,
Muhammad, if you don't accept our offer, then ask your Lord to give us the land and water which we lack, for we are shut in by these mountains. We have no river, and none live a harder life than we do.
With this, they destroyed Muhammad's stated justification for preaching Islam. The Meccans weren't gluttonous, as Muslims claim.
If you speak the truth, resurrect Qusay for us, for he was a true sheikh, that we may ask him whether what you say is accurate.
The Quraysh correctly identified the true patriarch of Islam, the founder of the Kaaba Inc., and the man who had invented the scam Muhammad coveted.
If you will do this, we will believe you, and know that God has sent you as an apostle, as you claim.
Muhammad did nothing, so...
Well, then, at least ask your God to send an angel to confirm your depictions of paradise and give you the mansions of gold you obviously crave. If not that, then send us the day of doom you threatened us with, for we will not believe you until you perform a miracle.
The Meccans knew that a prophet devoid of prophecies and miracles couldn't be what he claimed. What's more, they knew his God was powerless.
Why doesn't your God help you? Didn't he know that we were going to present you with these opportunities to prove yourself? Listen, Muhammad, we know the truth. Information has reached us that you are taught by this fellow in Yemen called Ar-Rahman. By Allah, we will never believe in Ar-Rahman.
The Meccans even knew the source of the Quranic revelations, a Hanif named after their god.
All right, then, our conscience is clear. When they said this, the prophet got up and left.
The Quraysh saw right through Muhammad's prophetic act. They exposed him and laid him bare, just as we are doing today. As you read these words, remember that the Sirah's Hadith are not only considered to be divinely inspired scripture, they represent Islam's most essential writings. The Sirah provides the lone chronology of Muhammad's words and deeds, written within 3 centuries of his death.
Ishaq, Muhammad, your people have made certain propositions. They asked you for things so that they might know that your position with God is as you say it is, so that they might believe and follow you. And yet you did nothing. They even asked you to hasten the punishment you were frightening them with, but you could not do it. The prophet went to Khadija, sad and grieving.
Ishaq tells us that the Quraysh escalated their verbal assault, calling Muhammad a
sorcerer, spitting and blowing,
and
an insane poet, preaching in rhyme,
and
demon-possessed, whispering delirium.
They said that his Quran was plagiarized.
Fairy tales of the ancients.
Yet with each new iteration, his familiar spirit had a ready Quranic verse, ever escalating the war of words. One of the most bizarre facets of this new game of put up or shut up involves some Jewish rabbis from Yathrib. The Quraysh sent emissaries to test Muhammad's claim that he was the last of the biblical prophets. We are told that the rabbis laid down a challenge.
Ishaq, ask him about the mighty traveler who reached the confines of both east and west. Ask him what the spirit is, and ask him what happened to the men who disappeared in the ancient days. If he does not know, he is a rogue, a forger, so treat him as you will.
While the Jews asked no such questions, the Meccans convinced Muhammad that they had.
So Muhammad said to the emissaries, I will give you the answers tomorrow. But the apostle waited for 15 days without a revelation from God on the matter, nor did Gabriel come to him. So the people of Mecca began to spread evil reports.
Fact is, the Meccans had fingered the Yemeni Hanif, and thus God, and our hero couldn't ask the Yathrib Jews, and thus Gabriel, because he thought that they had composed the challenge. Left to his own devices, Muhammad didn't do very well. He said that the answers finally came to him in the form of the 18th surah, aptly named
The Cave.
The last time he was on his own, searching for God in all the wrong places, Satan had met him there. This time his spirit friend said that the mighty traveler was a Muslim.
Quran 18, verse 83. They ask about Dhul-Qurnayn, Alexander the Great. I shall recite to you something of his story. We established him and gave him the means to do everything. So he reached the setting place of the sun and saw that it set in a muddy spring of hot black water. Around it he found people. He asked if he might punish them.
The story goes on to talk about extraterrestrials, mythical people, and to claim that the pagan Alexander was a Muslim. I'll present the entire story in the last chapter, as it ultimately points to our destiny. It is interesting, however, that the Quran says that the first thing the resolutely pagan Alexander the Great did was search out the place of the setting sun. Yet in all of Alexander the Great's conquests, he only journeyed east, never west. The
men who disappeared,
according to the Quran, were Moses and his servant. They were sailing, looking for a fish and some buried treasure. The inane story unfolds at the 60th verse and continues until God sends Alexander the Great off looking for the extraterrestrials. The verse that precedes these answers focuses on Satan.
Hellfire, punishments, deceptions, and annihilations.
I can only assume that the
spirit
is the devil himself. In fact,
the cave,
Surah ends with,
we have prepared hell for the hospitality of the infidels, because they disbelieved and mocked my signs and messengers.
However, Eshak believes the
men who disappeared
were
the dwellers of the cave of Rakim.
Beginning in the 18th verse, Allah claims that some men stayed in a cave for 300 years and argued about dogs. Ahmed Ali, in his translation of the Quran, says that the cave is the place the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. That's hilarious, and that the Qumran scrolls prove that the Quran is a complete lie. What this all means is, without Jewish and Hanif inspiration, Muhammad didn't do very well. The 18th surah is the Quran's most foolish. At this point, Tabati picks up the trail of the Quraysh bargain. The Meccans clearly understood Muhammad's motives. In one of Islam's most revealing hadiths, we discover,
Tabati, the Quraysh promised Muhammad that they would give him so much wealth that he would become the richest man in Mecca.
That would be money.
They would give him as many wives as he wanted.
Now we're talking sex.
And they would submit to his commands.
Lest we forget power. They didn't bother tempting him with an acknowledgement of his prophetic claims, by agreeing that he really was Allah's messenger. The Meccans knew the prophet's gig was just a means to an end.
The Quraysh said, this is what we will give you, Muhammad, so desist from reviling our gods and do not speak evilly of them.
This bargain was proposed on the basis of accommodating the Meccan gods. The deal was clear. The stakes were high. Sex, power, and money were being offered in an exchange for total capitulation. The oneness of Allah was all that separated Muhammad's Islamic doctrine from Qusay's scam. If the messenger accepted, he was through as a prophet, and Islam was finished as a religion.
Tabati, if you will do so, we will offer you something which will be to your advantage and to ours.
The prophet was evidently intrigued, tantalized perhaps. They held the keys to the Kaaba Inc. and were offering him a founder's share. This could be good.
What is it? He asked. They said, if you worship our gods, Alat and Aluza, for a year, we shall worship your god for a year.
Once again, it is both perplexing and incriminating that the Quraysh don't name Muhammad's God. After all, Allah was their God. In fact, Allah was supposed to be the proud papa of Alat, the female form of Allah, and Aluza. There is but one explanation for this omission. Muhammad was still referring to his God as Ar-Rahman, the deity of the Yemeni Hanifs. Those who codified the Quran decades later simply swapped Ar-Rahman's name out of some of the later Meccan surahs and replaced it with Allah. This change is confirmed by a hadith contemporaneous to these events.
Ishaq, Abu Jahl met the apostle and said, by Allah, Muhammad, you will either stop cursing our gods, or we will curse the god you serve. So the Quran verse was revealed. Do not insult those gods to whom they pray, lest they curse God wrongfully through lack of knowledge.
This became Quran 6:108.
I have been told that the apostle then refrained from cursing their gods and began to call them to Allah
rather than Ar-Rahman. The critical word is began.
Tabari and Ishaq. Walid, As, Aswad, and Umayyah said, Muhammad, come and let us worship that which you worship, and you worship what we worship. We shall combine in the matter, and shall make you a partner in all our undertakings.
The Kaaba Inc., the legacy of Qusay's religious scam, was still the principal game in town.
If what you have brought is better than what we already have, we will be partners with you and take our share. And if what we have is better than what you have, you shall be a partner with us in what we have, and you shall have your share of it.
Their schemes were virtually indistinguishable. They were only squabbling over ownership. Muhammad's immediate response to the Quraysh bargain should tell us all we need to know about Islam's lone prophet. He didn't say no. He hesitated and was clearly tempted to worship Allah and Al-Uzza if it meant money, sex, and power.
"Let me see what revelation comes to me from my Lord."
"Not Allah,"
he replied.
"Although I can't prove it using the Islamic traditions, in my opinion, Muhammad went to his aging wife, Khadija, and asked her what she thought he should do. After all, she had been the founder of Islam, the inspiration behind the profitable prophet plan. I think Khadija scuttled the deal. More wives would have been more competition. And although she would have relished the prestige of being a shareholder in the Kaaba Inc., what was she going to do with more money? She was over 70 years old and near death. So Khadija nixed the deal.
Then the following inspiration came from the preserved tablet. "Say, O disbelievers, I worship not that which you worship, nor do you worship that which I worship. And I shall not worship that which you worship, nor will you worship that which I worship. To you, your religion, and to me, my religion."
Sadi Tabari, I know that that is what the hadith says, but it just ain't so. The 109th surah from which this revelation was quoted was among the first handed down. It was revealed a decade before this bargain was struck. So what really happened? Khadija died, or was killed perhaps, and Muhammad accepted the deal. The very next line in the history of Al-Tabari, Muhammad at Mecca, confirms my theory.
Satan cast a false revelation on the messenger of Allah's tongue.
Possessed by the devil, Muhammad chose poorly. He succumbed to his demonic urgings and began to worship Allat and Al-Uzza. He was finished as a prophet. While the Islamic spin masters in Baghdad tried their level best to put lipstick on this camel, the whole affair was as ugly as it was deadly. No matter how valiantly they attempted to excuse Muhammad's behavior, a pig in makeup is still a swine.
Tabari. The messenger was eager for the welfare of his people and wished to effect reconciliation with them in whatever way he could. It is said that he wanted to find a way to do this, and what happened was as follows.
Before we wallow in what follows, I'd like to poke a hole in the excuse. Muhammad's people were long gone. He had sent them off to Abyssinia for fear they would be seduced. And the notion of reconciling himself to the pagans is laughable. Muhammad had done nothing but harangue them for a decade now, calling them names barely suitable for print. They teased him, and he said, "I will bring you slaughter." Sorry, Muslim apologists, I don't think so. The isnad, or chain of reciters introducing the hadith, reads,
Ibn Mumayyad Salama Muhammad Ibn Ishaq Yazid bin Zayed al-Madani Muhammad bin Kab al-Karazi.
I share this because of what happened to Salman Rushdie. He wrote a novel based upon what these champions of Islam had to say. Muslims went berserk. They had Rushdie's book banned and panned. They nailed satanic verses to crosses and burned it during hostile rioting. The Ayatollah Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic world at the time, put a fatwa on Rushdie, offering his fellow Muslims $1 million for the writer's head. Yet Rushdie had merely exposed Islam's own traditions. So why did they get mad at him? Was Muhammad so perverse and Islam so corrupt that modern clerics have to hide the truth for their doctrine to survive? Apparently the answer to that question is yes. This is what follows.
Tabari and Ishaq. The messenger saw his tribe turn on him. He was pained to see them shunning the message he had brought from Allah. So he
abandoned both his message and his God because he
longed for something that would reconcile his tribe to him. With his love for his tribe and his anxiety over this, it would have delighted him if the obstacle which had made his task so difficult could be removed.
So he could accept their generous offer of power, sex, and money. The only points of contention, thus obstacles to reconciliation, were Kaaba custodianship, the number of gods, and the top god's identity. Was he Allah or Ar-Rahman?
So Muhammad debated with himself and fervently desired such an outcome. Then Allah revealed, "By the star when it sets, your comrade does not err, nor is he deceived, nor does he speak out of his own desire."
In truth, he did all three, and was about to prove his guilt.
And when he came to the words, "Have you thought about Alat, Aluza, and Manat?" Satan, when he was meditating upon it and desiring to bring reconciliation, cast on his tongue, because of his inner longings and what he desired, the words, "These are exalted high-flying cranes or goddesses. Verily, their intercession is accepted with approval."
Simply stated, Muhammad said, "I accept the Quraysh bargain." But at what cost? The Quranic recitals had been filled with assertions that there were no intercessors. And four gods is at least three too many for a monotheistic religion. Muhammad had therefore abandoned the central plank of his mission. There is no Ilah but Allah. Islam was no longer monotheistic. What's more, the Prophet's grandiose and messianic claim of being Allah's intercessor was pummeled, stoned by a trio of rock idols. And that wasn't the worst of it. Islam's lone spokesperson had just aligned himself with Satan. It's little wonder the Ayatollah wanted Rushdie's book burned. It's little wonder the Quran urges Muslims not to pry too deeply into Islam or ask questions. The truth is devastating. The Quraysh bargain and satanic verses confirm that Muhammad was demon-possessed and that the Quran was inspired to advance his personal agenda. These hadiths prove Islam was a fraud, as counterfeit as a $3 bill. What's more, the profitable prophet plan has been elevated from highly probable to undeniable. But the Islamic hadith was not finished burying its prophet.
Tabari and Ishaq. When the Quraysh heard this, they rejoiced and were delighted at the way in which he spoke of their gods, and listened to him. When the Muslims, trusting their prophet in respect to the message which he brought, did not suspect him of a vain desire or slip, when he came to the prostration, having completed the surah, he prostrated himself, and the Muslims did likewise, obeying his command and following his example.
Now you know the reason why the world is in such a mess. A demon-possessed man sought to satiate his vain desires, and billions, failing to suspect his fraud, followed his example and obeyed his commands. If you were a Muslim reading these words, flee this delusion before it's too late. This despicable man and his demonic spirit are not worthy of your soul.
Tabari and Ishaq. Those polytheists of the Quraysh and others who were in the mosque likewise prostrated themselves because of the reference to their gods, which they had heard, so that there was no one in the mosque, believer or unbeliever, who did not prostrate himself. Then they all dispersed from the mosque.
In the context of the Quraysh bargain, this passage proves that Islam was nothing more than Muhammad's scheme to take what rightfully belonged to others. It was his personal gateway to money, to power and sex. The Kaaba Inc., the religious scam of the patriarch Husay, was being cashed in by a covetous and amoral man. The evidence is undeniable. Islam was a plot, not a religion. Allah and Satan are one. Independent Islamic scholars, even those sensitive to the religion, know that this satanic indulgence destroyed Islam. They recognize that nothing in the Quran can be trusted if the prophet can't distinguish between godly and satanic inspiration. And while they have a point, they miss the point. Apart from the initial cave demon, there never was any spiritual inspiration. The Quran, cover to cover, is too foolish, violent, demented, and amoral to be godly. The Meccans were right. It was from a madman, a plagiarizing poet, a far-fetched forger, a demon-possessed sorcerer. Surely there is a motive behind the Quran. Within the context of these traditions, we must also deal with the lesser issues. The passage confirms that Allah was one of many gods. Muhammad had promoted a pagan rock idol. The prostration prayer, the performance that distinguishes Muslims from other religious practitioners, was pagan too. So was the mosque, the cradle of Islamic submission. And the Kaaba, the center of Islamic obedience, was a pagan shrine. All five pillars of Islam crumbled in the wake of the Prophet's satanic indulgence. There were ilahs besides Allah. Muhammad was Satan's messenger, The prostration was a pagan rather than Islamic obligation, and everything was rendered naught by a devilish bargain. Even the religious tax became suspect, as it was orchestrated by a prophet who was tempted and trumped by the love of money. The religion of Islam died that day along with its founder, Khadija. But out of its ashes the political doctrine of Islam emerged. And while the prophet failed, the profiteer soared to ever greater lows. Acquiescing to temptation, accepting Satan's bargain, Islam turned from gray to black. As the sun set on the pagans mooning the Kaaba moon god, it also set on the religion of Islam, never to rise again. As much as Muslims would love to absolve themselves and their prophet of the Quraysh bargain and satanic verses by claiming that the hadiths were unauthorized, they were unable. Both history and their cover-up render their objections moot. Without the reconciliation that followed the bargain, there was no way to explain.
Tabari and Ishaq. The news of this prostration reached those of the messenger's companions who were in Abyssinia. The people said, "The Quraysh have accepted Islam." Some rose up to return. The angel Gabriel came to the messenger and said, "Muhammad, what have you done?"
Well, that's what the hadith says. The prophet first mentioned Gabriel's name 2 years later in Medina. But that's not to say he didn't have visitors. A trio of men, Baker, Umar, and Hamza, took their prophet to the woodshed. At least that's where they would have taken him had there been wood in Mecca. Islam's dark spirit was quoted saying,
"Ishaq, you have recited to the people that which I did not bring to you from Allah, and you have said that which he did not say to you. The messenger was grieved and feared Allah greatly. So Allah,"
not Gabriel,
"sent a revelation to him, consoling him and making light of the affair
of worldly bargains and satanic indulgences.
He informed him that there had never been a prophet or messenger before who desired as he desired and wished as he wished, but that Satan had cast words into his recitation, and he had interjected them on Muhammad's tongue and into his desires."
To hell with truth, literally. Desperate to save his prophetic mission, Muhammad retreated to familiar ground. He claimed that he was as covetous, as immoral, as demented, and as ill-advised as every other prophet. He was just dabbling in a little demonic delusion to satiate his cravings for sex, power, and money. It was no big deal. Only the Jewish scriptures couldn't bail him out this time. Neither the Torah nor the Talmud contained devilish tales that could be twisted to salvage his sorry soul. So none were given. There were no names dropped, biblical or otherwise. Muhammad was on his own. No prophet had ever
desired and wished as he had desired and wished.
The founders of Islam said,
"Ishaq, then Allah annulled what Satan had cast and established his verses by telling him that he was like other prophets and messengers."
Muhammad's Lord revealed,
"Every messenger or prophet before you recited the message Satan cast into his recitation. Allah abrogates what Satan casts. Then Allah established his verses. Allah is knower, wise."
This became Quran 22:52. One lie has been refuted with another. The 22nd surah would not be revealed for another decade. In fact, it was one of the final Medina surahs. But by reciting it, Muhammad destroyed his only alibi, denial. Now that the Quran has verified the satanic verses, Muslims cannot whisk them under the carpet without impugning Allah's credibility along with Muhammad's. Let's take a quick look at the surah to better understand Muhammad's mindset. But so as not to compound the prophet's error and take the passage out of context, I want you to know that the 47th verse of this late surah speaks of Allah's intended punishment on the Day of Doom. The 48th is about Allah overtaking townships. The 49th speaks of warnings. The 50th, forgiveness. And the 51st demeans the inmates of the flaming fire. Somehow that brings us to
Quran 22, verse 52. Never did we send a messenger or prophet before you, but when he framed a desire, Satan threw some vanity into his desire. But Allah will cancel anything vain that Satan throws in.
A second translation reads,
He recited the message Satan proposed, but Allah abolishes that which Satan proposes.
Another says,
Satan made a suggestion respecting his desire, but Allah annuls that which Satan casts.
And we have,
Whose recitation Satan tampered with, yet Allah abrogates what Satan interpolates. And Allah will confirm his signs or revelations, for Allah is all-knower and wise.
It was a devilishly delicate matter. So everyone seemed to have a little different take on what Allah allegedly revealed, albeit 10 years later. But no matter how you slice it, the Quranic excuse confirms the satanic verse episode actually occurred. The hadith cannot, therefore, be unauthorized. Muhammad is said to have allowed Satan to throw
some vanity into his desires.
This would be the Quraysh bargain. And to have allowed Satan to
tamper with the recitations.
That would be the satanic verses. Allah then canceled Satan's toss, abolished the devil's proposal, annulled Satan's cast, or performed an abrogation, the ultimate miracle of the Quran. But he never denied the Quraysh bargain or the satanic verses. Therefore, Muslims can't either. Allah abrogating the devil aside, the Quranic justification for the satanic verses ends with this treasure of spiritual inspiration.
Quran 22, verse 53, that he may make the suggestion thrown in by Satan, the devil's proposals, but a trial and temptation for those in whose hearts is a disease. Verily the wrongdoers are in a schism, and those on whom knowledge has been bestowed may learn that the Quran is in the truth from your Lord, and that they may believe therein, and their hearts may submit lowly before it, for verily Allah is the guide of those who believe to the straight way.
Muhammad succumbs to temptation, sides with the devil, and it's everybody else's fault other than his own. His indulgence was convoluted into a trial for the infidels, our schism. Then, after saying that Satan's proposals often slip into Scripture, we're asked to trust the Quran, to submit lowly before it. While this is revolting, it's also convicting. Muslims who try to deny the existence of the satanic verses must deny the Quran, for clearly it acknowledges them. That leaves Islam in an impossible position. Muslims must either admit that Muhammad was a power-hungry, money-grubbing, sex-crazed charlatan in cahoots with the devil, or they must deny the validity of the hadith and Quran. One leaves them without a prophet, the other without a god. Either way, they no longer have a religion.
Tabari, thus Allah removed the sorrow from his messenger, reassured him about that which he had feared, and canceled the words which Satan had cast on his tongue, that their gods were exalted high-flying cranes or goddesses, whose intercession was accepted with approval. He now revealed, following the mention of Alat, Aluza, and Manat, the words, Are yours the males and his the females? That indeed is an unfair division. They are but names which you and your fathers have given, to the words, To whom he wills and accepts.
This became Quran 53:21. Not only does this mean that Allah copy-edits Satan, it proves Muhammad didn't know where he was, or even who said what to whom, when. The aforementioned quote was from the 53rd surah, which came before the 22nd. In fact, the 53rd was the 45th surah handed down. It precedes the satanic event by many, many years. The 22nd surah was the 107th out of 114 in the order of revelation. The hadith says that these spiritual revelations followed one another, yet that is impossible. Not only is their order reversed, they are separated by a sea of words, hundreds of miles, and a decade of time. So Islam has a fatal problem. If the rationale for dismissing the satanic verse and Quraysh bargain episode isn't valid, or even plausible, Muhammad's motivations for establishing the submission religion were about vain desires, not godly revelations. There is no way for Muslims to differentiate between spiritual guidance and satanic deception. An acute problem considering how much of the Quran is fixated on Satan's realm, pain and punishment. Whether the Quraysh bargain and satanic verses occurred or not, the Quran cannot be trusted, for it claims they did. Further, a perfect and eternal tablet cannot be out of order, inverted, or grossly disjointed, especially on an issue of this magnitude. The entire validity of Islam pivots around the satanic verse, Quraysh bargain, episode. If Muhammad was enticed by sex, money, and power, and capitulated, as these hadiths testify, and the Quran confirms, Islam is finished. The credibility of its lone prophet is tarnished beyond redemption. His motivations are exposed for all to see. As a result, Qusay becomes the founder of Islam. Muhammad is simply a self-serving promoter. And Khadijah's profitable prophet plan suddenly becomes the only viable explanation. More devastating still, these events do not stand alone. Muhammad admitted that Islam was designed to enrich himself at the expense of others. We have examined his confessions, and his behavior from this point on, as chronicled by the Hadith, becomes entirely focused on sex, power, and money. As for Satan, Muhammad confessed to being demon-possessed. According to the Quran, his neighbors recognized the signs. They even offered to help him exorcise his demons. The fact that Muhammad admitted to having been inspired by Satan has caused many to say that Islam is satanic, and not without just cause. The evidence is overwhelming. The symbols used throughout the Islamic scriptures are all from the occult, the snake, personification of Satan, led Abraham to the Kaaba and revealed its foundations. A snake is the only creature said to have lived in the Kaaba. The darkened or crescent moon, another satanic symbol representing counterfeit light, is the religion's logo. Allah was a moon god. He swore by the moon. His stone was black. The darkness of night is the best time to worship him and recite his message. The Quran was endorsed by jinn, demons from Satan's tribe. Muhammad listened to soothsayers. He believed in magic spells. An occultist saved his father's life. Another wanted to lay with him. Even the seal of prophethood on Muhammad's back was said to look like an apple, the image of satanic temptation. And Satan played a starring role in the Quran, being named 10 times more often than Muhammad. Then there's the Quran's depiction of Allah. He spends his time in Satan's realm, tormenting the inmates of hell. He is never shown playing with the virgins in paradise. Allah, like Satan, is sadistic. He leads men astray, shackles them, and drags them into hell, where he is personally involved, using their bodies as the faggots for his fires. He turns men on a spit, makes them eat thorns, and pours boiling water on them for what he calls their entertainment. Some will protest that the same book and prophet call Allah merciful, and they claim that Satan is their foe. But that is the greatest proof of all. Satan never identifies himself. He is the master of camouflage. The Quranic orders to crucify unbelievers and wipe infidels out to the last, followed by Allah is merciful and kind, is perfectly transparent. It's exactly what the devil would do, appear to be divine while inspiring devilish behavior. In fact, the behavior in Allah's heaven would lead men to the biblical hell. Satan is the master of deceit. Black is white. The lie becomes true. And everything leads away from a relationship with the one true God. There are but 3 differences between Satan and Allah. And those differences cause me to believe that Islam wasn't wholly satanic. Satan is real. He is powerful and brilliant. Allah was imagined. He was impotent and foolish. Much of Islam was Muhammad's doing. He is to be despised, not pitied. He, like the demonic spirit that inspired him, must be exposed and rebuked. The Hadith claims that the Quranic remedy for the satanic indulgence is the 53rd Surah. Let's see if Team Islam gets itself out of trouble, or if it digs itself in even deeper.
The star
is named after Satan.
Quran 53, verse 1. I call to witness the star when it dips,
a.k.a. the morning star, the very name Isaiah ascribed to Halal bin Shakar, the demon we call Lucifer.
Your companion, Muhammad, is neither confused, deceived, nor misled, nor does he speak out of his own desire,
unless he's tempted with sex, power, and money.
It is a revelation revealed. He was taught this Quran by the supreme intellect, Gabriel.
Actually, Lucifer.
One free from any defect in body or mind. For he, Gabriel, rose and became stable in stately form, clear to view. While he was in the highest part of the horizon, then he approached and came closer, then he prostrated. He was at a distance of but two bow lengths, or even nearer.
So that there will be no confusion, each time Gabriel's name was read in this last quotation from the 53rd surah, it was actually inserted by the translators and is not there in the text itself. The claim that he was bowing, however, in this passage is telling. Neither Gabriel nor Lucifer would ever have bowed to any man, so Muhammad is ad-libbing here. Since the hadith says that Gabriel was the source of Quranic inspiration, Islam has tumbled into the abyss, no matter how this verse is interpreted.
Bukhari, Allah's apostle used to listen to Gabriel whenever he came, and after his departure he used to recite the Quran as Gabriel had recited it. Gabriel used to meet him every night to teach him the Quran.
But we have been told that Allah was the supreme intellect, that he was the most wise, all-knowing, and that he had no partners. Since Allah's Gabriel would never claim a superior position to Allah, this cannot be Gabriel. So who might it be? Here are some clues. The surah is named after Halal bin Shakar, the arrogant one who is the son of the rising sun, and it's presented in connection with the satanic verses. By way of witness, the
star
is calling himself the
supreme intellect, one free from any defect in body or mind.
The only angel who considered himself to be superior to God was Halal bin Shakar, Satan. For such blasphemy, Satan was thrown out of heaven. So now, he says he's not only landed on his feet in perfect stately form, he has risen. As clearly as words allow, he has just told us that he has fulfilled biblical prophecy and transformed himself into an angel of light to deceive a Gentile messenger with a new gospel and prostration. You'll find a complete analysis of Isaiah and Paul's prophecies and their Islamic fulfillment in the Mein Kampf chapter, starting on page 380, which we will read to you later. The satanic verse goes on to say,
Quran 53, verse 10. So he did reveal to his slave whatever he revealed. The prophet's heart did not falsify what he perceived he saw. Will you then dispute with him about what he saw? For indeed he saw him.
Him who?
At a second descent.
Oops, a descent is a journey down.
Near the lot tree, beyond which none may pass. Near it is a garden of abode, the seventh heaven.
Therefore, Muhammad's heaven is down, not up.
When that covered the lot tree, which did cover it, the sight turned not aside, nor did it go wrong.
I really did see him. At least I perceived I saw him. Why don't you believe me?
Indeed, he did see of the greater signs of his Lord.
Methinks, no, me knows. He doth protest too much, especially since we're in the realm of satanic verses and pagan gods.
Quran 53, verse 19. Have you then seen or thought upon Alat and Aluza, the two idols of the pagan Arabs, and considered another, the third goddess, Manat, of the pagan deities?
Manat was an afterthought because she was not part of the Quraysh bargain. Now for Allah's copy edits.
What? For you sons, the male sex, and for him, daughters, the female? Are yours the males and his the females? Behold, such would be indeed a division most unfair.
Muhammad just jumped from the devil's frying pan into the hellfires of sexism and discrimination. He is saying that Alat, Aluza, and Manat can't be Allah's daughters nor goddesses because they are girls. In plain English, it would be an injustice for men to have sons and for gods to have daughters because women are worthless. It's little wonder the Islamic politicians and clerics, who depend on Islam for their status, power, and wealth, threaten to kill anyone willing to expose this nonsense.
Quran 53, verse 23, These are nothing but names which you have invented, you and your fathers. for which Allah has sent down no authority.
Yes, they are names, names given to them by Muhammad's forefathers, just like Allah's name. Projecting one's flaws onto an opponent is standard political fare.
They follow nothing but conjecture and what they themselves desire, whereas guidance has come to them from their Lord. Nay, shall man have anything he hankers after, whatever he covets?
It sure seemed to work for Muhammad. The career move from prophet to profiteer would satiate his every craving. For example, when Muhammad wanted more women, Allah said,
Quran 33, verse 51, You may have whomever you desire. There is no blame.
Fortunately, we have ratted him out. This surah is as transparent as it is incriminating.
Quran 53:26, And there are many angels in heaven whose intercession does not avail, except after Allah has given permission to him whom he pleases and chooses. Those who believe not name the angels with female names.
This is Quranic waffling. Muhammad is trying to please both Meccan and Muslim. He is saying that the female goddesses could be angels, and that Allah might consider allowing them to be intercessors after all. The next 8 verses can be summarized by, The Meccans know nothing and want everything, and Muhammad knows all and wants nothing. Then,
Quran 53, verse 36, Nay, is he not acquainted with what is in the pages of the books of Moses and of Abraham, who fulfilled all that?
Muhammad is admitting that the Torah was the source of his inspiration, but he doesn't know much about
all that.
A dozen verses ramble nowhere with lines like,
It is he who makes you happy and morose,
before heading back to the world of pagan astrology and mythological people.
Quran 53:49. He is the Lord of Sirius, the mighty star the pagan Arabs used to worship. It is he who destroyed the powerful ancient Ad people,
who actually never existed,
and the tribe of Thamud he spared not, and before them the folk of Noah, for that they were all most unjust and rebellious. And he destroyed the overthrown cities of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Actually, Allah didn't know their names, but the translator did, so he helped his God out, and they were added within parentheticals to the text.
So there covered them that which did not cover, making them ruins unknown.
The writing quality is as impoverished as the message. The Bible says that the ruins of Sodom and Gomorrah will serve as visual confirmation of Yahweh's judgment and salvation. The Quran says that the ruins are unknown. Since archaeologists have found Sodom and Gomorrah, their brimstone should serve as a visual confirmation that Allah is a liar. And please don't be troubled by the slur. Now that we know that Allah was modeled after Satan, it's a compliment.
Quran 53, verse 56. This is a warner of the warners of old. The threatened hour is nigh. None besides Allah can remove it. Do you then wonder at its recital? And will you laugh at it and not weep, wasting your time in amusements?
That's a hoot. With countless wives, sex slaves, and child concubines, Islam's prophet was the king of frivolity.
So fall you down in prostration to Allah and serve.
Since neither the 53rd nor 22nd surah redeemed Muhammad, we are left with the profitable prophet plan being the only viable explanation for Islam.
Tabari, when Muhammad brought a revelation from Allah canceling what Satan had cast on the tongue of his prophet, the Quraysh said, Muhammad has repented.
Actually, he reneged on
what he said concerning the position of our gods with Allah. He has altered
the bargain
and brought something else. Those two phrases which Satan had cast on Muhammad's tongue were in the mouth of every polytheist. They became even more ill-disposed and more violent in their persecution of those of them who had accepted Islam and followed the messenger.
The pagans had the prophet on the ropes, and they knew it. Not only had he lied and broken a promise for personal gain, he had destroyed his credibility and abandoned the central pillar of his doctrine, the oneness of a spirit that only spoke to him.
The Muslims who had left Abyssinia,
which is today's Ethiopia,
upon hearing that the Quraysh had prostrated themselves with the prophet, now approached. When they neared Mecca, they learned that the rumor of the Meccan people accepting Islam was false. They returned to their families and said, "You are more dear to us
than Islam," is the implication.
The people reversed their decision.
Considering the distances and the speed upon which news and people traveled, Muhammad may have gone as long as a year before he bailed out on the Quraysh bargain and Allah's little girls. The indulgence cost him most of his converts. This admission of failure is followed by a second variant of the satanic verses. It ends with this admission.
The messenger said, "I have fabricated things against Allah, and I have imputed to him words which he has not spoken."
The Quraysh bargain and satanic verses conclude my case against the religion of Islam. As I promised to demonstrate, the doctrine has completely destroyed itself. Yet the rest of the story is both entertaining and foreboding. While these confessions from Muhammad and Allah enable us to close the books on the religious scam, accepting their guilty pleas, a new scam is about to unfold. This one is political, and this one prevailed. Khadijah's death, or murder, was followed by the passing of the Prophet's protector, Uncle Abu Talib. With them gone, Muhammad spiraled out of control. He became ever more paranoid, delusional, and demented. With his Kaaba now unquestionably pagan, the Prophet desperately needed a new Qibla, so he imagined himself flying a Barak to Jerusalem. With his age sex partner gone, he needed young love, so the 50-year-old Prophet married a 6-year-old girl. With his protector gone, he needed a new show of arms, so he promised some pagans paradise in return for the protection pledge of Aqaba. With his audience tainted, he needed a new pool of victims, so he picked up his tent and hightailed it to Yathrib. And because the Prophet had left the strong arms of Umar, Hamza, and Baker out of the Quraysh bargain, they ultimately persuaded him to renege on the agreement. So he dumped the goddesses and became a pirate. Muhammad's last year in Mecca was mayhem and madness.
Tabari, the deaths of Abu Talib and Khadijah were a great affliction to the messenger. After the death of Abu Talib, the Quraysh went to greater lengths in molesting him than they had ever done during his lifetime. One of them even poured dust on his head. The Prophet said, "The Quraysh never did anything unpleasant to me until Abu Talib died."
Islam's Prophet needed someone to protect him from all of the verbal abuse.
Ishaq, when Abu Talib died, the messenger went to Taif to seek support and protection against his own people.
The Taif were chiefs and nobles of the leading tribe in Taif.
He spoke to them about the requests which he had come to make, that is, that they should come to his aid in defense of Islam and take his side against those of his own tribe who opposed him.
If Allah were really a god, do you think Muhammad would have to ask pagans from a neighboring town to defend him? But what if Islam were really a political doctrine designed to suppress and enrich? Would a failed profiteer ask a Meccan rival to join his enterprise? The endeavor might at least make sense under those circumstances. But the Taif were as unimpressed with Muhammad as were the Quraysh.
Tabari and Ishaq, one of them said, "If Allah has sent you, I will tear off the covering of the Kaaba." Another said, "Couldn't God find somebody better than you to send?" The third added, "I shall not speak to you, for if you are Allah's messenger, as you say, you are too important for me to reply to, and if you're lying, you're too despicable to address."
Muhammad's motivations were so transparent, the Taif were instantly convinced he was a charlatan. The combination of the Quraysh bargain and satanic verses were devastating to Muhammad's, Allah's, and Islam's credibility.
Muhammad left them despairing of getting any good out of the Taif.
The fact that he couldn't convert them to Islam and save their souls was unimportant. He despaired because he couldn't get anything from them.
I have been told that he said to them, "If that is your decision, keep it secret and do not tell anyone about it," for he did not want his tribe to hear about the matter and be emboldened against him.
A prophet begging pagans for protection was nearly as embarrassing as a prophet patronizing pagan deities for sex, power, and money. It's little wonder our desperate profiteer was squeamish about any of this getting out.
However, they did not comply with his request, and incited against him their ignorant rabble, who reviled him, shouted at him, and hurled stones, until a crowd gathered and forced him to take refuge in a garden a long distance from town.
Huddling in the garden, Muhammad claims a Christian came to his aid, handing him some grapes. When the quivering prophet took them, he said,
"In the name of Allah," and then he ate. Adas looked him in the face and said, "By Allah, those words are not used by the people of this country."
This depiction is no more credible than any other Christian endorsements of Islam. Allah was the Arabic word for God, and no one was going to confuse Yahweh's name and character with Allah's name and nature. Even the Ta'if pagans knew Allah. What's more, 3 pages earlier, another hadith ripped this notion to shreds. The pagans in Mecca were said to have posted a document in the Kaaba, which began,
"In your name, O Allah." Muhammad said, "From what country do you come, Adas, and what is your religion?" He replied, "I am a Christian from the people of Nineveh."
Nineveh, after having been reprieved by Jonah for 100 years, rebelled again and was destroyed 1,000 years earlier. But the error is not without merit, for it explains the reason behind this fable. Muhammad's journey to the Ta'if is being recast as heroic and godly, just like Jonah's prophetic mission to Nineveh.
The messenger said, "From the town of the righteous man Jonah, the son of Matta?"
Jonah was from the Nazareth area in Israel. The Assyrian capital was hardly his town. He despised the place. What's more, his father's name was Amittai, not Matta.
"How did you know about Jonah, the son of Matta?" he asked. The messenger replied, "He is my brother. He was a prophet, and I am a prophet."
The truth is, he heard about him from Zayed.
Adas bent down before the messenger.
Prostration to prophets isn't Christian behavior.
And he kissed his head, his hands, and feet.
The story goes on to say,
"Muhammad has told me something which none but a prophet knows."
If that's true, how did Adas know it? By presenting us with this confirmation, Muslims are actually confirming that they have lost the ability to reason. Now that we have a Christian endorsement, how about another from Satan's tribe, the jinn?
Tabari and Ishaq. When the messenger despaired of getting any positive response from the Thaqif, he left Ta'if to return to Mecca. When he was at Nakhla, he rose in the middle of the night to pray, and as Allah has told,
in the Quran,
a number of jinn passed by. Ishaq says that he was told that there were 7 jinn from Nazibin of the Yemen.
Ishaq continues,
they listened to him, and when he had completed his prayer, they went back to their people to warn them, having believed and responded to what they had heard.
According to the Quran, jinn aren't people. They are invisible spirits that lead men astray. Members of Satan's tribe, they're made of fire, like that found in hell.
Allah mentioned their story when he said, in Quran 46, verse 29, "Behold, we turned you towards Muhammad, a company of jinn, who wished to hear the Quran. But when they stood in the presence thereof, they said, 'Give ear.'"
For the third in a series of demonic endorsements,
Quran 46, verse 30, "We have heard a book revealed after Moses, confirming what came before it. It guides to the truth and to a straight path. O our people, hearken unto the one who invites you to Allah, and believe him. He will forgive you your sin, and deliver you from a penalty grievous. If any does not hearken to the one who invites us to Allah, he cannot frustrate Allah's plan on earth, and no protectors can he have besides Allah. Such men wander in manifest error."
Yet again, Allah is the demonic lord.
Tabari, the messenger came back to Allah and found that its people were more determined to oppose him and abandon his religion, except for a few weak people who believed in him.
Just when you think the Islamic traditions have pounded the final nail into Muhammad's coffin, they find another. Following the Quraysh bargain, the satanic indulgence, the pagan protection fiasco, and the jinn endorsement, we are told that Muslims rejected Muhammad. Imagine that. They
abandoned his religion, except for a few weak people.
10 years into Muhammad's mission, the score in the little burg of Mecca, 5,000 people strong, is Islam 10, pagans 4,990. Following the satanic verses, Allah was enshrined as Islam's God. The 40th surah, aptly named
The Forgiver,
is typical of those revealed during the late Meccan period.
Quran 40, verse 1. Ha-mim. These letters are one of the miracles of the Quran, and none but Allah understands their meaning. The revelation of this book is from Allah, exalted in power, the all-knower, the forgiver, the acceptor, the severe in punishment.
Now that we've been properly introduced, it's time to get down to business. Allah's business.
Quran 40, verse 4. None can argue or dispute about the signs of Allah or His revelations but the unbelievers.
Islamic states make it a criminal offense for anyone to argue or dispute anything pertaining to Muhammad, Allah, the Quran, or Islam. The penalty for expressing such an opinion is death. Simply stated, Islam is the least open, least tolerant dogma ever conceived by man.
Let not their strutting about or their turn of fortune deceive you, for their ultimate end will be the hell fire.
This must be the verse Islamic warlords quote to quell their subjects today. Sure, those Western democracies are prospering while we live in the squalor of Islam, but don't let their good fortune deceive you into believing that their success and our failure is a result of our religion's moral poverty.
No, never. It couldn't be. Allah would never harm you.
Freedom obliterated, political correctness imposed, it was time to corrupt a Bible story, to make the Meccan rejection of Muhammad seem somehow prophetic.
Quran 40, verse 5. Before them, folk denied, the people of Noah, and the confederates of evil after them, and every nation has plotted against their prophet to seize and destroy him.
There is no record of an Islamic prophet coming to any nation, much less every nation. Saudi Arabia didn't become a nation until 1932, when the British elevated a warlord to king.
They disputed by means of falsehood to contemn the truth. So I,
this is now first person,
seized and destroyed them. How terrible was my punishment! In this way, the sentence of your Lord.
The speaker has returned to third person in mid-thought.
Against the disbelieving infidels was justified. They will be the inmates of the hellfire.
The change of speaker that permeates the Quran is important. The voice is confused because the real source was confused. Muhammad didn't know if he should steal his scripture from Qusay, Zayed, or Moses, or simply claim credit for himself.
Quran 40, verse 7. Those angels,
actually demons,
who sustain the throne and around it sing praise to their Lord and believe in Him and ask forgiveness for those who believe. Our Lord, your reach is over all things in mercy and knowledge. Forgive those who repent and follow your path. Save them from the torment of the blazing fire. Grant that they enter the gardens of Eden.
The Quran doesn't explain the basis for forgiveness. In the religions upon which Islam was based, an atoning sacrifice is required. It is the same with all rational societies. Commit a crime, and a judge will require you to sacrifice your money, your freedom, or your life, depending on the severity of the offense. The only sacrifice in Islam is an inducement. It's as if God can be bribed, His favor bought. So in Islam, sin is without consequence, and the result is chaos. When forgiveness is capricious, anarchy reigns. This oversight is one of the many reasons Islam is impoverished. It explains why Islamic states require tyrannical oppression to maintain a semblance of order. With predestination, there is no choice, and without choice, what follows makes no sense.
Quran 40, verse 9. And ward off from them ill deeds, and he from whom you ward off ill deeds that day, him verily you have taken into mercy. That is the supreme success.
Destined to hell.
Verse 10. Lo, those who disbelieve will be informed by proclamation. Verily, Allah's abhorrence is more terrible than your aversion to yourselves.
Allah abhors men. Another translation reads,
Allah's hatred of you is terrible, seeing that you were called to the faith
of submission,
and you refused.
It's another sign that Allah is not Yahweh. The God of the Bible abhors deception, evil, false gods, and false religions. But he loves men, even men and women caught in deceptive, evil, and false doctrines. So we're dealing with Satan here. The abhorred inmates of Allah's hell.
Quran 40 verse 11. Will say, Our Lord.
Which would make Allah available in hell and the Lord of hell.
Twice you have made us die, and twice you have made us live. Now we have recognized our faults. Is there any way out of this fire? The answer will be, This is your plight, because when Allah was invoked as the only object of worship, you rejected Islam. But when partners were joined to him, you believed.
Translated into English, this means, When Muhammad accepted Allah and discarded Ar-Rahman, and when he promoted Allah's little girls to goddesses, his adversaries believed. But the non-monotheistic, satanic indulgence didn't work out so well. Ever the hypocrite, Muhammad says that if anyone follows his example, they'll burn in hell.
Quran 40 verse 13. It is he who shows you his ayat, his signs and proofs.
According to the Quran, there were no miracles, ever. Allah never so much as rolled over. However, the hadith contradicts Allah's book and says,
In Bukhari, the Meccan people requested Allah's apostle to show them a miracle, and so during the lifetime of the prophet,
they haven't a clue as to when,
the moon was split into two parts. On that, the prophet said, Bear witness
to my God. Since there is no evidence to corroborate this fanciful tale, I'm surprised Muslims don't claim that putting the moon back together, as if it had ever been torn apart, was a miracle too. Now that Allah is the spirit of Islam, it's time to elevate his status.
Quran 40, verse 14. So call you upon Allah, making worship pure for him, even though the disbelievers may detest it. Owner of high ranks, owner of the throne, by his command does he send to any of his slaves he pleases, that it may warn of the day of mutual meeting.
To make this appear like it's scripture, 8 words were added to the text so that it would at least approach being intelligible. If this is scripture, the perfect word of their God inscribed on an eternal tablet, why must so many words be added into the text? Here is that same verse as it is rendered in modern English translations.
So call you, O Muhammad, upon Allah, making your worship pure for him in obedience, even though the disbelievers may detest it. He is the owner of high ranks, owner of the throne. By his command does he send the inspiration to any of his slaves he pleases, that it may warn men of the day of mutual meeting. Quran 40, verse 16. The day whereon they will all come out of their graves, not a single thing of them is hidden. Who will be in control that day? Allah, the One, the Irresistible.
God would not ask such a question or answer it so absurdly. The spirit depicted in these scriptures is hardly irresistible. Another translation adds,
Allah himself will reply to his question.
A third, however, ends more in keeping with Allah's demeanor.
Allah, the subduer of all. Quran 40, 17. This day every person shall be rewarded for what he earned. No injustice shall be done. Surely Allah is quick in reckoning.
With the pseudo-religious stuff out of the way, it's time to get mean.
Warn them of the day of doom that is drawing near, when hearts will jump up and choke their throats, filling them with anguish, and they can neither return their hearts to their chests nor throw them out. No friend or intercessor will the disbelievers have. Allah knows of the tricks that deceive with treachery and all that the bosoms conceal.
Allah continues to be the master of deceit.
Quran 40 verse 21. Do they not travel through the earth and see the end of those before them? They were superior to them in strength and in the traces they have left in the land, yet Allah seized and destroyed them, and they have no one to defend them against Allah. That was because their messengers kept bringing them clear signs and proofs of Allah's sovereignty, but they rejected them, so Allah seized and destroyed them, for He is strong, severe in punishment and retribution.
Allah is the God of seizures, destruction, punishment, and revenge, but not love. Sure sounds demonic to me. All right, enough with the pain and punishment. It's time to indulge in Allah's other hobbies, plagiarism and self-delusion.
Quran 40:23. We sent Musa, or Moses, with our signs and proofs and an authority manifest, a clear warning to Firaun, or Pharaoh. But he called him a sorcerer telling lies. Now when he brought them the truth from our presence, he said, slay the sons of those who believe with him, and keep alive their females. But the plots of the unbelievers end in nothing but errors and delusions, in the state of perdition.
The liberation of the Jews from Egypt is faithfully recorded in the book of Exodus. Proven accurate by archaeologists, it has endured unaltered since 275 BC, when scholars in Alexandria, Egypt, translated the Bible into Greek, the lingua franca of the day. Yet there is but a faint echo of this great victory of faith in Muhammad's forgery. Rather than correct Allah's ignorance, I'll simply present his version. If you're interested in the truth, read Genesis and Exodus. However, as you ponder the Islamic perversion, consider Muhammad's motive. He had been spewing his caustic brew of lust and torment for a decade, and had nothing to show for it. Lacking credibility, prophecy, miracles, and originality, he stole these things from Moses, a man who had them all. Every word of what follows parallels Muhammad in Mecca, and his war of words with the Quraysh establishment.
Quran 40:26. Said Pharaoh, leave me to kill Moses, and let him cry to his Lord. What I fear is he will change your religion and cause mischief to appear in the land. Moses said, I have called upon my Lord and your Lord for protection from every arrogant one who believes not in the day of doom.
Pharaoh's god was Amun-Ra. Mighty temples were erected to him. The moon god of Mecca he was not. Allah's rock pile and his puny black stone weren't in Amun-Ra's league. This leads to the line that brought us to the 40th surah.
A believer,
thus a Muslim,
a man from among Pharaoh's family,
therefore not a Muslim,
who had concealed his faith
in Islam, a religion that wouldn't be invented for another 2,000 years,
said, will you slay a man because he says, my Lord is Allah, when he has come to you with clear signs from your Lord? If he be a liar, on him is his lie. But if he is telling the truth, then some of that scourge of Allah, the calamity, which he threatens, will befall you. Truly Allah guides not one who is extravagant and lies. O my people, yours is the dominion of this day. You have the upper hand, being dominant in the land. But who will save us from Allah's punishment, should it befall us?
What's with the O my people speech? Moses and his brother Aaron went alone to Pharaoh. Sure, there were Jews enslaved in Egypt, but they were miles away making bricks. The only people within earshot of Pharaoh were Egyptians, members of his staff and family.
Quran 40:29. Pharaoh said, I point out that which I see, I guide to the right path. Then said the man who believed, O my people, truly I fear for you something like the fate of disaster of the Confederates, something like the fate of the people of Noah, Ad, and Thamud, and those who came after them. But Allah never wishes injustice to slaves.
There isn't a trace of the Ad, and even if these imaginary people actually existed, they wouldn't have arisen in Arabia until centuries after this conversation occurred. As such, these words could not have been spoken. Therefore, Allah is lying. This dark spirit lies because it's in his nature to lie.
Quran 40:32. I fear a day when there will be mutual wailing, a day when you shall turn your backs and flee. No one shall defend you against Allah. Any whom Allah causes to err, there is no guide. That is how Allah leads the skeptic astray.
The unnamed Muslim in Pharaoh's household sounds an awful lot like Muhammad in Mecca. If they aren't the same person, they sure had the same speechwriter.
40:35. those who dispute the signs and verses of Allah without any authority, grievous and odious, hateful and disgusting. It is in the sight of Allah and the believers.
If my scriptures were this odious and hateful, I'd consider their exposure disgusting too.
Verse 36. Pharaoh said, O Haman, build me a lofty tower that I may attain a way to reach the heavens, that I may mount up and look upon the Ilah of Moses. But as far as I am concerned, I think Moses is a liar. Thus was made alluring in Pharaoh's eyes the evil of his deeds, and the plot of Pharaoh led to nothing but perdition.
Allah wants us to believe that the Egyptian king ordered his people to build the Tower of Babel to reach God. What's more, his Haman is from the book of Esther, and also tied to the land of the Babylonians, not the Egyptians. But at least Pharaoh knew that in 1900 years, the Arabic word for God would be Ilah, not Allah.
Quran 40, verse 38. The
nameless Muslim
man,
masquerading as Muhammad,
who believed, said, O my people, follow me, I will lead you to the right path, Islam. This life is nothing but enjoyment. It is the hereafter that is the abode to settle. Whether man or woman, a believer is such as will enter the garden of bliss. Therein they will have abundance. And, O my people, how strange it is for me to call you to deliverance while you call me to the hell fire.
Muhammad tipped his hand again. The
right path, garden of bliss,
and
hell fire
were his most notorious themes, his signature.
Quran 40:42. You call me to blaspheme against Allah and to associate partners with him whom I have no knowledge.
This unknown partnership argument is nonsense played in Egypt. Their gods were exceedingly well known, and they were unabashedly numerous.
Without doubt, you do call me to one who is not fit to be called to. The transgressors will be the inmates of the hell fire.
The great unnamed masquerader wasn't finished exposing his real identity or his purpose.
Quran 40:44. Soon you will remember what I say to you now. My own affair I commit to Allah, for Allah ever watches over his slaves. Then Allah saved him from every ill that they plotted against him. But the brunt of the penalty, the evil doom, encompassed on all sides of Pharaoh's folk.
During this whole long-winded speech, the unnamed Muslim never uttered the words for which Moses had been sent, Let my people go. And that's because Muhammad's recreation of the saga between Moses and Pharaoh was designed to liberate Allah's prophet from criticism, not Jews from bondage. With every word sounding like Muhammad in Mecca, the perversion of Moses in Egypt continued, this time with a recap of Allah's favorite subject.
Quran 40:46. In front of the fire will they be brought and exposed morning and evening, and the sentence will be, Cast the people of Pharaoh into the severest torment, the most awful doom. Behold, they will argue noisily with each other while they wrangle in the hell fire. The weak ones who followed will say to those who had been arrogant, But we followed you. Can you then take on yourselves from us some share of the fire? The arrogant will say, We are all in this fire. Truly Allah has judged between slaves.
Even with a change of scenery and exposure to the dominant culture of the day, Allah remains mired in the inferno of the Arabian desert. This Quranic charade is speaking on behalf of a religion that wouldn't be conceived for nearly 20 centuries.
Quran 40:49. Those in the fire will say to the guards and keepers of hell, Pray to your Lord to lighten the torment for a day. They will say, Did there not come to you, your messengers, with clear signs? They will say, Yes. Then pray as you like, but the prayer of the disbelievers is futile and will go unanswered. They will present their excuses, but they will only have the curse and the home of misery.
The tirade ends by revealing the source from which the raw material was stolen.
Quran 40:53. We showed Moses the guidance and caused the children of Israel to inherit the scripture book, the Torah.
The 40th surah is too long to cover start to finish. But before we say goodbye to
the Forgiver,
consider this.
Quran 40, verse 70. Those who deny the book and what we have sent down with our apostles will soon come to have iron collars and chains around their necks. They will be dragged through the boiling water and then thrust into the fire to be burnt.
We have changed gods, but it wasn't an improvement. Imagine for a moment that you're Ibn Ishaq. You're in Baghdad 130 years, or about 5 generations, after Muhammad brought these disasters upon himself. A caliph waltzes in and orders you to write the Islamic gospel, the life of the Prophet Muhammad. But all you have to work with are oral reports called hadith, handed down father to son over the vast chasm of time. You put quill to paper, but your hand shakes. With every word you destroy, demonize actually, the man responsible for the political dogma under which you toil. His scriptures are as twisted and dark as his life. So what do you do? To his credit, I think Ishaq wrote down what he was told. If a hadith explained an otherwise incomprehensible Quran surah, if it explained otherwise unjustifiable rituals, if it explained the change in the nature of Arabs that led to their bloodthirsty conquest, it made its way into his surah. So this lone scribe established Islam, literally. Ishaq is responsible for virtually everything Muslims know about Muhammad, his God, his scripture, and his religion. And it isn't good.